So, welcome to today's compiler construction. Last time we've been terminating with the large topic of parsing and have gone over to the semantic analysis phase of the front end of a compiler. And as such, the theoretic concept that kind of describes what you can actually express in that type of setting was for us the attribute grammars. We have seen that we already had such a system going on for the Berezethi algorithm in the very beginning of the lecture, and we have come to a version that is more general than the one which was very specialized for just those four special purpose attributes, to a general attribute grammars. And for that, we were looking into the topic of how to come up with an evaluation strategy for such systems, and we're thinking about whether actually there is a chance of having a successful static evaluation strategy at all for such systems. And we came to the conclusion that we had to verify that for all possible trees, derivation trees of these grammars, we could reassure that the attributes in there, especially the dependency graph of those attributes, will never form a cycle, because as soon as we have a cyclic dependency in there, well, there will obviously be no solution to such a system. So we were behind algorithms that would tell us whether all possible attribute dependencies in all possible trees for an attribute grammar would be free of cycles. And we came to the realization that that would be a very expensive algorithm to check. So we were looking into special cases, which were this strong as this algorithm for checking for strong acyclicity as a property of attribute grammars, and that would be a cheaper version, which would have the drawback of only certifying a stronger precondition than the one that we actually really need. But we can compute that that property in reasonable time. So now we want to continue with talking about actual ways of implementing evaluation runs through such an attribute system. And there's several ideas of how to do that. First of all, the most obvious one is probably just let the user define an evaluation order and don't bother at all with performing any automatic way. Well, that's something that you can always do, but that's not very exciting to review here. And there's the idea of having automatic strategies based on the actual dependencies in the system. And there's ways of doing that, for example, by using the local dependencies in the systems in order to come up with the order on of attributes which we want to evaluate next. For example, suppose we would require the computation of the N attribute for the first child over here. That would require to have the F attribute computed already, which would require that to be attribute to be computed. So this would trigger a whole sequence of other computations, and that would be our sequence which to compute, and there's several ways of achieving an automatic way of doing that. There would be, for example, the idea of trying to set up a dependency graph between the different attribute kinds, in the sense that you would prioritize the evaluation of a certain attribute if it is not depending on anything else, and thus providing dependencies to other attributes, which would then in turn be computed afterwards, and try to traverse the AST once for each of these attributes and compute the value of one of these attributes in each pass. This might be possible in some systems, however, that might not go well in all the cases that are out there, since you can think of cycles in that particular graph, because you would have to gather all the dependencies throughout all the different node types that are out there, and yeah, this might not go well for you. There's also a dynamic version, which we will see in the next slide, I think, and then there's the other idea of fixing strategy first and only allow attribute systems that can be evaluated with that particular strategy, also a thing that we will see on later slides. So for possible automatic strategies, we can, for example, focus on demand-driven evaluation, which would start with the evaluation of any required attribute, and we would evaluate recursively the attributes that we depend on. And then there's the evaluation in passes, which would incorporate managing the, these strategies between them. As an example for demand-driven evaluation, because that for me seems quite natural, would be, for example, once again in our world of Barry Sethi would have been the attributes next for the leaves A2, A3, and B4, for example. If we would tag them as being of interest, we would have to evaluate the particular other attributes that we depend on. And for example, for the next leaves at A3 and B4, for example, we find ourselves, as we are in a node of type alternative, only to be dependent on the parent's attributes. So we would have to rely on that information being present. So we would have to evaluate that recursively. So we could try to evaluate the values of A3 and B4 in one go. And here we are in the context of a concatenation, and as the right child, we would only depend on the next of the parent, so we would trigger the evaluation of this thing, and once again we are within the boundaries of a concatenation. So we once again depend on the parent's value, and I think that is already was given beforehand for that, wasn't it? Yeah, I think so. So that would be the way to go for recursive evaluation for those two things. It gets a little bit more tricky if you look at, for example, the next attribute for this node ever over here, as it relies on a whole lot of other attributes to be already present. So you might trigger the evaluation of another few things, but in the end, as there's no circle in circles in there, at least in these strongly acyclic attribute systems, you would at one point in the end then terminate your recursive evaluation. So that would be the demand-driven evaluation. If you considered your instance of the of the syntax tree of such a thing as a base for several of those queries. You could, for example, also try to cache the intermediate results that you have computed for evaluation of your desired leaves. So you would store all the intermediate results of other attributes. You would just store them in there and keep them there for further evaluations of other interesting attributes, and thus save yourself a few cycles of computation time. Yeah, for something like that to actually work, if you would go the way and really implement them as a system with a tree in mind, you would have to keep a pointer to the parents from the children, obviously, because you might depend on those. And you would have to keep in mind that only the required attributes are actually evaluated. So if you're interested in all the in the computation of all possible attributes in those systems, you would have to mark them all as interesting. Thus, maybe there's more ideal strategies than the ones in there in terms of navigating through these trees. So this demand-driven evaluation is something which is actually not a local algorithm in that sense. So it seems that computations of all attributes can be achieved in a cheaper way than that. Maybe, just as a side remark, you would not want to consider something like locality in the tree as a desired property of the system at all. If you, for example, try to get rid of the complete tree structure and just try to consider the system as just a system of assignments of some variables to each other and just write them out as a kind of a lengthy branch-free assignment sequence, so to say, and keep them in a kind of a priority queue, which would sort by the criterion of which right-hand side variables would already be evaluated so far, and you would just evaluate one by one all the right-hand sides for which you already have intermediate results in there, and by that way just get rid of the whole tree thing at all. So maybe the tree-centric view of the whole thing is a little bit too close to the to the source of the equations, and it's not an optimal way for computing at all. But yeah. In terms of this demand-driven evaluation, you see a lot of implementations out there that just go through the trees. If you try to evaluate in parsers, then well, you could essentially do something like like I said just a minute ago. You would try to evaluate those equations for which all the arguments are evaluated as of yet, and you would try to determine a sequence of visitations such that you can solve a large number of those equality systems if you still keep to this kind of tree structure, which I think is a little bit outdated, but that's out there as a theory for these kind of pass evaluations. I will skip a little bit through that because I find it not that not that intuitive as an optimal implementation for the whole problem at all. And skip to a point where we talk about how you would actually try to model a few important ideas in these attribute systems. One of the ideas is that for computing meaningful results for the attributes, you might want to have something like state of computation in there, depending on the position where you actually are in the tree. And that is something which seems quite difficult to express at first, since you just have these kind of attribute equations and no concept of timing when you actually evaluate that particular bit of the tree. But there's a solution for that also, and that's what you see in that example here. The general problem would be that for that particular example, we would like to have a numbering of the leaves of a syntax tree of some sort. And for that, we need a context. The lowest currently not taken number, for example, would be the context of that, which we would have to manage in some kind of state. So, to achieve something like that, there's this general pattern of using these helper attributes that are some kind of, which is always a pair of attributes that you would consider as helpers for communicating the state, and you would use one of these attributes to pass the value of the state while descending down into the tree, and the other attribute while to communicate the state while ascending back up from visitation of a tree. So we would call these for, well, we need some name to describe them as pre and post. This is the pair of attributes that we need for that. And let's see how we would model our numbering of leaves with these kinds of attributes. We would start the numbering from the root by saying that the beginning state is, well, the lowest number that we have seen right now is just zero. So we consider zero as the state to start the whole computation, and we would pass that down into our tree by this line over here from our root. So we would set the pre of the child being the same state as the one from the parent, and we might have to somehow receive the state back from the child. Thus, as this is a synthetic direction, we would set post of zero to be post of one. In intermediate nodes, what we would do is we would essentially pass around the value of the state from the parent to the child, and from the child back to the parent in case that we come back from the visitation of both of the children. And there's one peculiarity in there, which is this one over here. That is the communication between two siblings. And what you would need to do there is, in case you come back from your left sibling, you would have to communicate the state, or the recently updated version of the state, over to the right sibling. So we would set pre of two to post of one. And the only thing that remains now is the actual counting of the leaves. So in case we reach the leaf itself, what we would do is we would take the incoming state and take the value from in there, increase by one, and consider that as the number of our particular leaf at that point, and increase the number that we have seen as the new state for everything that follows from there. So we would just increment it by one and set the post state of my leaf as that value. Doing so gives us an attribute system which is apparently strongly acyclic, because it's only having a limited kind of dependency that you can set up in such a system. You can descend from parent to child, you can ascend from child to parent, but apart from that, the only thing that you can do is you can let information flow to the right from one sibling to another. And with such a system, you will never be able to reach the original source of information, so to say. Thus, you would never be able to construct a cycle in such a system. Yeah, so that also already leads us to the definition of systems that are representing that the thing that we have announced a little bit earlier, which would be a subset of attribute grammars for which would be suited quite well for evaluation with a static strategy, particularly this depth-first search and pre-order, post-order traversal of the tree. And that would be these L-attributed grammars. They can actually be evaluated with such a system. So these are important grammars, and they are characterized in the following way. If you look at all the productions of an L-attributed system, you would realize that every inherited attribute of SJ would only depend on either the inherited attributes of its parent or the attributes of its left siblings. So, what is it? The left siblings. That is what you can see by looking at the indices over there. So, for an attribute of symbol SJ, it would only depend on the attributes of the siblings S1 to SJ minus 1. And that would lead to a structure that, pretty similar to the one that you see sketched over here. And that is the L attribute grammars now. They are quite important because of several facts. First of all, these L attribute grammars can be evaluated during parsing, and especially they can already be incorporated into parsing already with LL-based parsers. So even your most simple, typical recursive descent parser implementation can perform attributation in L-attributed systems while still running on the input. So that is quite a nice thing to have. And the other thing is that you can express quite a lot of important properties of programming languages in L-attributed grammars. One of the examples that you see for that is the bucket calculator that you will or already have seen in the tutorial. And yeah, usually you would try to massage all your systems in a way that they fit somehow into L-attributed grammars by partitioning your attributes in a way such that you can have one run through your syntax tree in that first traversal and already have all your attributes evaluated. And in general, if you don't, if you're not lucky enough that everything fits into one depth first traversal, you would try to set up phases of traversals after each other, where you, in between you would repair the dependencies that don't fit in that thing. So that is quite the useful thing. It's also very, very practical in the sense that a lot of properties of real programming languages fit into the core set of L-attributed grammars, such as the ones that you need for type checking and inference of types, particularly if you have to apply symbol tables in order to check for declaration use and type information, and even code generation in particularly the simple form that we will see a little bit later on in the course, they all can be specified in terms of L-attributed grammars. So with respect to computer languages, L-attributation is already what covers most of the semantic analysis that you need for simple translations. If you're after more sophisticated optimizations, you might have to check other means of harvesting information out of your either syntax tree or intermediate representation, but that is more the topic of program optimization lecture and not this particular one over there. In the most compilers that you will see, what will be done is that those attribute evaluations will at some point annotate the syntax tree with the desired information, in the sense that it will leave certain attributes filled with the information that you actually seek. And yeah, this will in many ways influence the your point of view with which you observe that particular node in the tree. For example, you would depending on the attributes that are found, for example, at identifiers in your syntax tree, you would consider certain things as input variables or output variables. You could mark them as function names or variable names or whatever. So it's actually an important thing to annotate your syntax trees with additional information. In terms of implementing attribute systems, what you would do in an actual compiler depends a little bit, of course, on the language that the whole system is based, and whether there is some kind of automatic way of installing something like attribute equations in there. In the generic version, where you don't have any means pre-given, what you usually instead have is some kind of syntax tree that you get out of there, and you're on your own to somehow come up with a way of computing your attribute equations. What you could do in those systems is, for example, you could implement your own recursive calls to some methods, which would then try to evaluate the, these equations. So you would have to come up with a lot of recursive functions. Or in the end, you might realize that if you do a lot of those different recursive calls, you will end up with re-implementing depth-first search for each one of them, and in the end decide that that is something that you are really sick of, so you try to abstract away from that by once and for all implementing your depth-first search in an abstract way. And that is what these visitors on recursive data structures give you. So how would something like that look like? You would concentrate the matters of a particular computation in one entity of your software, which is then called the visitor, and you would hand this visitor with the information of what to do over to the actual syntax tree, which would accept such a visitor and perform the depth-first search by itself in a generic way. And each time that a point of interest is passed during such a depth-first search, it would trigger a callback function in the visitor, where then the problem-specific method that the user provided for that particular visitor would be called and would have the chance to do anything. And in the end, control would go back to the depth-first visitation engine, which would then continue on with the next interesting point during depth-first search and once again call the visitor until it has finished visiting the complete tree. And how something like that is realized in an object-oriented system? Well, of course, as you know, implementations can differ quite a lot if you ask different people. One of the propositions that I have seen occurring quite often in these Java-based systems would be to do something like that. You would have some kind of base class for each of the nodes in your syntax tree. For the regular expressions, you would have this regex thing, for example. And what all of them have in common is that they accept visitations of a particular abstract visitor interface, which could be specialized for different purposes. In concrete classes of the regular expressions, you would overwrite that with a more specific version. So, for example, here in the OR expression of the regular expressions, what you would do is you would implement such an accept for still the generic visitor thing, and in there you would once again perform accepts. Well, maybe like this. There's an accept on a thing called L, which is the left child of the OR expression. And somewhat later, you would call accept on the, in this case, it is R, which would be associated with the right child of the OR expression. And in between, you would do a lot of things related to informing the visitor of the current state of the visitation of the tree. In particular, what you would do is you would notify the visitor with a call that you're about to descend into your left child, and for that you would always call something like this pre thing, because you are in the about to descend. Then, if you have finished with your left tree, you would, for example, call something like this inter thing, which would to signify that you are in between of two visitations of children. And in the end, you would call this posting, for example, to signify that we have finished with visiting all of the children and now are about to ascend to the parent. So what you see in these accept methods is are two kinds of calls, ones that are related with the actual depth-first search, and the others are related to informing the visitor of occurrence of certain events. What's now missing is then the visitor. How does such a visitor actually look like? That's what you see over here. And all it does is it would offer its collection of callback methods. Those are the ones that you have seen already in action during one of these accept methods. It's these pre and post methods, and also maybe the inter methods, and they are just predefined such that they actually somehow exist in the visitor and can be called during the depth first search. And in the abstract visitor, like we see here, it's just there's just no implementation given for these things, but you can customize this by inheriting from such a visitor and overriding the particular callback methods that you're interested in, such that you get notified whenever you, for example, descend into a new tree, or whenever you ascend from a completed visitation of a certain thing, and customize depending on the kind of thing that you're that you are visiting or have visited by paying attention to what the parameters of your visitation methods actually are. And in an example for the leaf numbering, that looks like that, or could look like that. Sometimes you see another layer in there, which would introduce kind of common behavior for certain visitations, like you see over here, where the binary expressions or end and whatever you might have in your tree all call to a common pre, post, or inter implementation of on the more abstract version of the expression. In this case would be the binary expression. You might you're already shaking the head. Well, it does not always pay off to have such a layer in there. So if you have a lot of these types of analyses going around, you might have a lot of similar use cases where you're actually not interested in a particular expression, but just in cases where you have two children. In these cases, it makes sense. It does not always make sense to do such a thing. You all know it in these object-oriented systems. You can put a lot of effort in over-engineering a lot of layers in there, or even not. It's just a proposition of what you can do. You don't need to do that in all the cases. For the concrete implementation of a visitor, what you would do in such a case is, well, the leaf numbering is exactly such a case where you're not actually interested in the kind of the node that you're visiting, except for the case that you actually found a leaf in there. So in that situation, you would use this newly introduced layer, this abstract visitor, because you don't want to pay attention to whether it's an OR expression or an AND expression. In both cases, you have to just descend and communicate the state and all that. And that's not so important, which is actually what the kind actually is. So you abstract away from that and consider that as an abstract visitor. And all you now need to do is you need to implement the pre, post, and inter visit methods for, well, for the abstracted binary expression, which would be those, as well as the leaf, and that is in the context of the regular expressions, it's just constants, I think, that are out there. So these would be the methods that you would need to implement, and maybe also you would like to do something about initialization of the whole thing, so you also add a constructor, and I'm pretty lazy and have not much space on my slides, so I misuse the constructor for starting the complete run through my syntax tree. But actually what I would do is probably separate these things. But anyway, what I do here is I use a hash map for storing my my attributes. That's a design decision that you find being applied in those systems, but the other one would be, for example, actually really introducing concrete variables at each of these nodes that would represent the carrier for that information, but it depends on your design of your data structures. In this here we have a hash map that carries all the information associated with the nodes, and what you would do there is, well, you would put the current state of the computation as the value associated with the root node R in there, which would be 0. So far we haven't found anything. And then we would let the whole system run by calling accept on the root node with this, which would be our customized visitor, and this would then run through the whole system, putting new state into our hash map each time, and it would now depend on what we're actually doing. Well, maybe not starting with this one. If we find ourselves to be in a pre-visit, we would put for the left state, for the left child, the state of the parent in there, which would communicate just the number down into our tree. We would then, when we actually reach the child of such a thing, we would then try to obtain the current number from there with n.get of r, increase that, maybe store that somewhere or put it out on the command line or whatever we want to do with that. I didn't put that into the implementation over here, but what I put in there is that it would be communicated as the new state for that particular node, and could be used in this inter callback to be given to the right sibling of a binary expression, in case there is one, and that would start or that would provide the descending run through the right sibling with the right state, and in the end, at some point, we would reach the post visit of a binary expression where we would. Was it actually leaf numbering, or is it computing the number of leaves in there? That's a little bit odd. I think that's somehow confused. The line over here more looks like computing the number of leaves in total and not numbering the leaves. Yes, so I think that should be different. That should be more something like get of right, so something like that. What would you say? Well, collecting the right branches state would be the thing that I would think is appropriate in these situations. Anyway, that is the way that you would work with such a system. You would customize your callback methods and somehow gather your information either in attributes of these nodes or in a hash table associating information with your node. Good. That leads us to the first application of such a system, which would be the declaration use analysis. What's that all about? Well, typical situation where declaration use analysis is actually providing valuable information is languages where we have a concept of scopes, of names. For example, in, once again, Java code, that is something which would is it actually Java code? That's something that you get when you inherit slides from someone else. Yeah, that doesn't really look like Java code. Bullshit. Yeah. Well, consider that to be something like not another thing, but maybe if a zero or something. So actually to be a statement that carries a block behind. So yeah, you cannot really nest function definitions in that way, at least in Java code, so that's bullshit. But anyway, consider that to be just nested blocks of some way, and not that way, but yeah, that's something that exists. And what you get from that is that within the nested body, nobody's seen that, the declarations that are outside can be what is called shadowed. So if you reuse an identifier that already has been declared in the scope or one of the scopes before, then reusing that name leads to shadowing of the previous definitions and the introduction of a new local definition that is then associated with that name. That's shadowing. What makes the whole thing so complicated is that for each declaration of a variable, you actually require the allocation of a certain fraction of memory for that particular variable. And even more, whenever you find a reference to that variable later on, you need to somehow find the declaration to which the access is actually bound to. So why is that? Well, usually at the declaration you somehow store the information where you would allocate memory for that. So that is the actual piece of information that you're really interested in, the location of the memory that you refer to with the reference. And associating these the references with the memory thing is where we use these declaration use analysis for. So just once again, even elaborating on the bogus example. Well, nice. Good. Yeah. Anyway, what we need to do in order to compute on the on the syntax tree some code generation, we somehow need to translate access to a variable into an actual memory access in some way. So what we need to do is that for each identifier that we encounter, we rapidly need to access information about its declaration and where the memory can be found. Usually in literature, it is just everything is just about putting a pointer to the actual declaration into an attribute. So that that is what our goal actually is. For rapid access, we also usually don't work on the plain source code identifiers, but instead, usually we identify identifiers with some kind of unique integer and use that as keys, because just comparing those is faster, and it also removes this notion of shadowing and intersection of names and all that. So going from textual representations to keys would be key for that part of the analysis. So by doing that, we would link each usage of a variable to the declaration of that variable. And so one of the things that we do for that would be we would have to replace strings with integers. So this seems quite a trivial thing in systems like Java, where we get everything for free, just like hash values. But for other languages, you might need to work a little bit harder on that. So what is the general thing that we desire to do? We get as an input a sequence of strings, and our output would be a sequence of numbers and a table that allows us to retrieve the string that is meant by that number. And that is something that we can already do during scanning if we want to just replace strings with values. Later on, when we do this declaration use analysis, we might even go further and and apply unique identifiers for variables which we decide to keep apart from each other based on their scoping. But in general, what we need is some way of relating indices with identifiers. So we need to convert the string into some number. And for that, we introduce a function index for identifier, where we manage a global counter in order to give unique numbers and manage them within this index for identifiers, and produce a hash table that that stores the numbers for each of the identifiers in a way such that if the string is not yet present in the hash table, we would put it in there together with it the currently lowest number, and increase the lowest number. And in case that is already it is already there, we just return the number from in there. So the algorithm is not that difficult so far. In case that we somehow are able to obtain a hash value for strings. I don't know whether you have already thought about something like hash values for strings. If not, then here's the slide for you. We hash tables for strings, we would allocate an array of a sufficient size m, and would have a hash function that would provide us with indices based on the size of the of a hash table somehow, and the general desired properties for such systems would be that the hash function is somewhat cheap to compute and would distribute the words somewhat equally over the span of numbers that we have available for distributing them. So for lists of things, well, strings are actually just lists of characters. There's several concepts of or generic choices that don't even pay attention to what is actually occurring in these systems. There's ideas of choosing certain hash functions. Well, the probably most precise one in the sense of actually respecting the complete content of such a list would be to iterate through all the members of the sequence and somehow use each of the characters to contribute to the hash value, which would be the solution that you see here listed as hash function 1, where you would do a sum on all the occurring members of the list being connected with each other by some kind of base value, which you then increase each time that you add up a new value of that, and in the end you would force the whole thing to collapse into the to the range of numbers that you have available for storing your thing. That is quite the typical way of somehow relating strings or sequences of things with numbers. If you have attended the tutorial this morning, you might have seen something similar in there. The other way, because, well, you have this precondition of the hash function being cheap to compute, would be quite the radical change to that, and just saying that, well, the intermediate elements of my list are just not of interest to me. What I do is I just take the first element and the last element and do the sum on them and distribute them over my range. Might already suffice for you in case that your the end and the beginning are not somewhat constant in your system, and that might already yield quite practically good working, well working examples for you. All in all, what you get is, particularly if you just condense everything to the first and last letter of your string, is what you get is your hash value might not be unique. Well, too bad. But in those cases, what you do is you don't actually keep your hash table referring to only singular elements, but instead what you do is you just append a list of all the items that are mapped to the same value and just perform either sequential search or some way of binary search on that thing until you actually find your entry, where you can then read off the number with which you associate your particular entry. So if all turns out to be somewhat equally distributed, you get average accesses of insert in O1 and lookup in O1, depending, of course, a lot on the actual hash functions and the values that are put in there. You'll know how programmers work and how identifier names are actually chosen, so you can make up your own opinion on how good that might work in these situations. As a kind of a generic example for replacing strings with integers, you see enlisted a sequence of somewhat, well, words in this case, and see the whole thing applied on there. So you associate each of the so far not found input words with the new with the current counter and increase. So the first few words which are where there's no duplicates in there, for example, all lead to the introduction of a new identifier in there until at some point you reach a word once again so that you get 0 occurring in the sequence once again. So that is the desired output, and that would lead to the kind of administrational data structures that you see over here. That's the intermediate structure of a hash table, which keeps track of the, well, haven't chosen my number of slots too cleverly for, well, 9 words, a hash table with 7 entries, well, yeah. But for the sake of displaying them on the slides, that's what you somehow get. And you can see that there's at least quite short lists that you create here for searching for your things. Okay, so back to our original application, referring references to declarations, or uses to declarations, the topic of symbol tables. To actually check for the correct usage of the variables, you need to traverse the syntax tree in left to right manner, of course, somewhat, because declarations need to be at first. And in such a way, you would expect to encounter a declaration before it's actually used. And consider it as then visible, and particularly you would consider the last one that you've visited as the currently visible declaration. That is something which is perfect with these L-attributed grammars, or with visitation runs that actually follow this depth-first search to the left, and then continue on through propagating information to the bottom, back up from the bottom, and between siblings only to the right. So that's L-attributation. However, what you need to perform in these equality systems is that you need to take care of this special features of basic blocks or scopes, which have an influence on the visibility of certain identifiers, in the sense that you introduce visibility of an identifier, but you also need to remove the visibility of an identifier, be it to either decide whether there is an actual declaration that that can be associated with the use at all, or be it for the case where there are several of these declarations, and you need to find out which one it is. So you need a system that adds or removes identifiers from the concept of being visible. So what has turned out to be quite useful for that is, since you have this this layering of scopes, where you can only temporarily override a scope, but in the end, at some point, you fall back to the original scope. That is a typical situation where you would manage or do well with a stack. So you would keep track of your declarations in stack form at some point. So if we visit a declaration, what we would do is we would push it onto the stack of its particular identifier, and when we leave its scope, we would remove it from the stack again, conceptually at least. In case that we don't visit a spot where we fiddle around with the scopes themselves, we can also have usages of identifiers, and at that point, what we would do is, well, in case that we encounter a usage of identifier A, we would check for the stack associated with that identifier, and consider the topmost entry as the one that's currently visible. In case that we can't find anything on the stack, we have found a situation where there's no declaration at all visible for a certain identifier, so we need to report back an error that this identifier is not declared at that position. As an example, consider this system where we have variables A, B, and C being associated with the keys 0, 1, and 2. So we can find stacks of their visible declarations. And yeah, let's maybe check for the interesting bits, meaning places where something changes in scope and or definitions. And first of all, we would start from the beginning of the program where there's nothing visible, so the stacks are all empty for each of these identifiers. So then we would, for example, when going through the syntax tree, at some point reach, for example, that spot over here, and here we would find declarations of A and B, so we would put those as the declarations for the outermost scope in there. So we would consider A and B to be declared at V and W. So it's just some abstract way of designating the memory references that get created here. So it's that's nothing technical here. It's just a way of quickly determining what we have to refer these names to. So at first it's just V and W. Then at some point we might reach a new block where we reach another declaration. This leads now to another A and a C, with associating A with memory X and C with memory Y. So what we would do is we would push them on the stacks for each of the variable names. So here we would push X onto the stack for A, leading to X being the currently visible memory address for A, and C we would push over here and create Y on there. And for B, we do nothing, as there's nothing nothing declared there. So now, when we find an access to A, like this one over here, what we do is we look up in our current list of stacks of declarations for the variables under A, accessing this thing here, and find that here this store goes directly to memory address X, as opposed to memory address V, which would be the alternative choice here. But since A is shadowed from the declaration over here, we find it being hidden in the stack somewhere deeper. Okay, same goes for A, for this occurrence of A, which is also referring to this thing. But in the end, for example, if we access something like B, which was also declared over here, this has not been shadowed by anything, so the original memory reference is still on top of the stack, and this B still accesses the old memory reference from over here. And in the same way, we go on. Here we have a new interesting spot where we close an old scope and open a new scope. So what conceptually has to be done is we need to remove the memory references that we have stored for A and C, because we're leaving a scope for those things, And instead we need to open a new scope. So these have to go away. And we need to add a new memory reference Z for this identifier Z, which is here added. So this will end up in the new environment that you see over here, where we have restored V as the memory reference associated with A. B hasn't changed at all, and for Z we have changed from Y to Z, and we can happily now compute with the new version of C, accessing this Z now, and B still all the time being a reference to the old W, and only when we pass the next closing of the scope, we remove the newly allocated Z from the whole thing, creating the original situation of our environment, and passing that scope will in the end remove everything. But I think I haven't modeled it there. So that would conceptually be what you would like to have over here. However, that might be quite tedious to implement. Why is that? Well, generally, if you think back to what the tools are that we have for performing these syntax tree analysis, is that we have callbacks for certain interesting situations. For example, callbacks whenever we pass closing of a scope, or whenever we pass a declaration. But what we don't have so easily is that whenever we pass the closing of a scope, we don't directly get access to all the declared variables during the current scope. So we somehow need to manage information about what is actually what has been newly declarated in that particular scope for each of the scopes that we have opened so far at some point within our analysis of declaration use, at least if we do it in a way as we do it here. So it's not as naive as it looks like here. But in principle, what you would do if you get the declaration use analysis is that you would relate the each occurrence of an identifier with its actual definition. So you might wonder what all these identifiers are representing, and in the end, when you have done your declaration use analysis, you would get links from the occurrences or the uses of your identifiers back to the declarations that you associated with them with respect to the scopes that they are found in. So it's quite the useful shortcut to the actual information that you desire. So, as I've said, it's not a very easy thing to actually come up with a way to remember which variables have been added to the set of currently visible variables during the current scope. There are certain ways of dealing with this problem out there, and they all lead to these concepts of symbol tables. So what you could do, for example, is refrain from using a register of actual variables with each of them having a stack associated, but instead you could manage just a linked list where you would enter pairs of identifiers and their declarations one by one, and thus creating just one linked list, which you would run through from the end where you push new variables onto whenever you pass a declaration, and just take the first one that you encounter because that was the most recent one that has been pushed on there. In such a structure, you can actually also push markers for opening of new scopes on there. So in case that you pass a closing scope, this closing bracket, you can just scan your list for the last occurrence of opening new scope and remove all of the entries from there, thus removing all the newly added declarations, and yeah, be happy with that. But you buy into that with the drawback that you have to run through the complete list of things in order to find the most recent occurrence of your identifier. If it is a globally defined thing, you will find it at the very bottom, for example. So you might not want to do something like that. Instead of lists of symbols, what you would also consider would be to use a list of hash tables, for example, that and would associate a hash table with each of the scopes, so that you don't have to run through the complete list, but only through the complete list of scopes. So you get a compression of depth that you need to search for your variables. So instead of having to search through all the variables to reach the global things, you only would have to search through the stack of scopes until you reach the global scope. This would save you already quite the time. An even more elegant solution would be to make use of persistent data structures, so that you would add... well, I don't know if persistent data structures are things that that you're used to. Well, what you essentially get is with each modification to your data structure, you would not be able to use the old reference, well, you would still be able to use the old reference to your data structure, but it doesn't reflect the changes. Instead, as soon as you modify your data structure, you get a new reference to a data structure that consists the same things that haven't changed as the old data structure, but the last performed change is reflected in the new reference. So with something like that, you kind of share information between your data structures wherever they don't change, and only have to pay for introducing some kind of management overhead in order to incorporate the changes in the reference to the more actual version of that. What that gives you is this notion of progressing into newer versions of your data structures while being able to revert back to an older version quite easily by just storing the old reference to that data structure at that point of time. And that gives you perfect tooling for implementing these hash tables, since you would create new versions of these persistent tables each time that you pass a new scope with the new declarations incorporated into the new version. Your new persistent version of your symbol table would still share the same information that you have in your original scope, but carry with itself the modifications that it has done to the visibility things. This could be used internally without any consequences to the old version to provide it to even more child scopes, and they would be able to use it freely as they wish, and as soon as you don't need them anymore, you just remove these management data structures in there and just go on with your old versions of your thing. So these are perfectly suitable for simple tables. Yeah. I don't know how far these persistent data structures have made their way into the so-called mainstream programming languages. There's in the functional world, that's something which is quite common, but I think at least for the C++ and Java platforms, there's at least third-party providers for such persistent data structures. But it's even not that hard to come up with implementations of them by yourself if you can find anything like that. But yeah, that's what you usually would use for such things. You could also do kind of a poor man's persistent data structure by cloning the original symbol table when entering a new scope, perform your changes in there as you wish, and upon passing the closing of a scope, you would just throw away your manipulated version and revert back to your original hash table that you have stored in some kind of stack or something. So that's kind of the poor man's version of that. Has a little bit more overhead, but still the same comfort than before. So, yeah, then there's not so much time left, but that should be just fine for a few peculiarities of languages. For example, the type definitions in C, which are a little bit odd at some notion, so to say. So that's a peculiarity that you find in the type system of C that might bother you when performing, when trying to implement a parser for C, for example. And that would be the actually quite useful feature of typedefs. Why is that? Well, typedefs, first of all, what is that? With that, you introduce synonyms for more complicated types. For example, you could install a shortcut to the type struct, which would represent a tuple, just x and y, and call it pointy. And you could even make use of that to make it more obvious what you're actually doing. For example, for recursive types, you could introduce just an abbreviation for your type as list T, and then define your recursive type in that way, for example. But anyway, what's the problem with these type definitions? Well, there's a lot of fuss in the C grammar going on about what token are actually used for the names that you introduce in these things. So if you try to obtain the language standard documents for the C language, you can do so. I think the library also has the original NCC declaration as book in there, and you find quite nice grammar for that with a lot of rules, and are already quite happy to have something like that until you reach the section that deals with type defs, because then it kind of quits the grammar view and escapes to natural language, and then says that the type def production, for example, would expect the name to occur in the form of an identifier, which would be considered to be, well, with the typical lexical structure of having characters, combinations with numbers and underscores and whatnot you can use in order to declare such an identifier. And from the point on, when you have passed the declaration of that thing, pointy
here in that example would have to be considered to be something else. Particularly, it would have to be considered to be a token of the name type name. So this thing here, So this thing here would have to be considered to be an identifier, while this thing here would have to be considered to be a type name token. Tokens are usually to be classified at the level of a scanner, which has only information regular expressions. Well, isn't this nice? Can you really perform this kind of differentiation? Well, at first you're still quite enthusiastic and say, well, it's not that bad at all. We might just use the same lexical specification, and inside the action function for that specification, we just keep track of all the type tests that we have seen. We might get that information from the parser and flag certain things as being associated with type names, so forth, and not with with identifiers. But then you realize, well, as soon as you have something like a look ahead of a certain size into your input, you actually determine tokens of a certain amount before you actually consider another production as being completed. What that means is, as soon as you start introducing type names with such a type def thing and try to complete that thing and commit, for example, this point T thing as a type name, you already have read the next line to a certain amount. And for example, in the in that case here, the very first thing that is used is such a point T thing. How very nice to patch in retrospective, so to say. So you have to somehow somehow rewrite your look ahead symbols to be of another type. However, you have used this look ahead to disambiguate between shifts, reduces, or reduce reduces already. Yeah, that's the practical things that you get struggle with if you deal with real world grammars and sessions. Luckily, if you think long enough about your problem, you realize that as soon as you use a look ahead of just size one, you can just make that thing into a right hand side, read that in your look ahead, and then luckily have already stored the right information in your data structures. But that costs a lot of time. So, yeah, that's kind of a real-world anecdote. You see a little bit of textual description of what is actually behind that. One way which does not work too well to get around that thing is would be to introduce a rule that would associate type name with an identifier. If you do that, you'll get, I think it was a three-digit number of shift-reduce conflicts added to your generated parser. Good luck with that. And registering the type name earlier is the way to go, but needs a little bit more thinking and engineering in that. So that's kind of a real-world anecdote for you, and maybe motivates why not all the practical examples that you see in lab courses or tutorials to be real-world examples, but more reduced to a certain copable amount of complexity. So, with that, next time we will continue with type checking. Apart from that, I think I'm going to terminate right now, and we have a short break until we continue with the tutorial section. Thank you.